This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Last week, we heard an in-depth conversation about the future of telemedicine in eastern North Carolina and how new technology could be used to provide access to specialized health care for people living in rural and underserved areas of the state, such as Bertie, Beaufort, Duplin, and Edgecombe counties. This week, we continue our coverage of telemedicine with a feature about how it's being used to make up for a shortage of psychiatrists in North Carolina. According to Deputy Secretary for Health Services and Acting State Health Director, Dr. Robin Cummings, 58 of North Carolina's 100 counties have too few physicians addressing mental health issues.
It's severe. We have counties where there's no psychiatrist at all. And so patients are simply not being appropriately addressed.
Dr. Cummings estimates that the need for psychiatrists will only increase as the population of the state continues to grow and people age. To make up for the deficit, a concept called telepsychiatry is being implemented at local hospitals and healthcare providers in eastern North Carolina and across the state. The state's telepsychiatry program begins operating in January 2014. The $4 million project was announced by Governor Pat McCrory and Health and Human Services Secretary Aldana Vosh in August at East Carolina University in Greenville. Acting State Health Director Dr. Robin Cummings.
The need for more and more care will increase. We've just got to be smart and use technology to tie the limited number of providers to the growing need and number of patients.
Telepsychiatry involves a two-way interactive audio-video link that matches a patient with a consultant, similar to FaceTime or Skype. The psychiatrist can conduct a consultation from anywhere in the world, but Dr. Cummings says the consultations in North Carolina will be conducted through ECU's eBehavioral Health Telepsychiatry Center.
The patient is will be placed into a room by a nurse or by an associate at the emergency room. The nurse will take the vital signs and transmit those to the consulting psychiatrist. The system will be activated. There will be a psychiatrist on the other end, and the two will be connected, and the patient will then be interviewed by the psychiatrist.
The patient will see the psychiatrist on a high-definition monitor screen, and the psychiatrist will be able to see the patient. But the doctor will be able to control the patient camera to monitor body language during the consultation.
This equipment that we use is actually able to zoom in, and the psychiatrist can watch the patient, obviously their hand movements. They can watch their eyes and see if their pupils are dilating or constricting. They can see sweating on the skin. Very, very sensitive video equipment. And so a full consultation is conducted.
Dr. Cummings expects the process will be straightforward and cost-effective. Once an initial investment is made, maintaining the telepsychiatry equipment is very low. And as the procedure becomes more available, Dr. Cummings believes it will drive down the cost even more, making the process very affordable for patients.
In terms of cost, if the patient has insurance, the insurance will pay for this just like they would for a regular patient-doctor interaction. So there's no additional cost there. Medicaid also reimburses. Medicare reimburses.
Since telepsychiatry can be implemented at small rural hospitals, patients won't have to drive long distances to see a doctor. The concept of telepsychiatry isn't new, but it's becoming accepted. And thanks to technological advancements, it's also becoming more accurate, too. While some people see the concept of telemedicine as beneficial, others believe it can never replace an in-person visit with a physician. Dr. Cummings disagrees.
Patients react to it, to the technology very well. Obviously, folks have televisions, they have computers, and so everyone's very familiar, very comfortable with the concept of a screen. Talking to the psychiatrist through a screen takes about a minute or two of accommodation, just getting accustomed to the situation. And from there, it really becomes an interactive situation.
In a world of online chatting and smartphones, it's not surprising that adolescents actually respond better to telepsychiatry sessions.
Children really just absolutely take this technology and don't hesitate at all to interact. Children this day and time just deal with technology. They grow up with it. It doesn't faze them at all.
North Carolina's new interest in telepsychiatry is based on the successful telepsychiatry project started by Albemarle Hospital Foundation in 2011.
Came to the attention of the Department of Health and Human Services. We gathered a work group together and began looking at how we could expand what they had done with their their project over 2 years and expand that statewide. So the project actually is already up and running, 14 hospitals going. We have about 30, maybe 32 hospitals on a waiting list right now to get going.
In North Carolina, there are over 108 hospitals with an emergency room, and less than 50% of those have 24/7 access to a psychiatrist. Dr. Cummings says rural hospitals that currently do not provide psychiatric care will be among the first to be added to the state's telepsychiatry program as it rolls out in January. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East. Marine Corps Air Station Camp Lejeune is honoring more than 240 Americans killed 30 years ago when terrorists attacked the military barracks in Beirut that was home to a U.S. peacekeeping force. The remembrance ceremony will take place Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. at the Beirut Memorial. Many of the 241 killed were from Jacksonville because Camp Lejeune's 24th Marine Amphibious Unit was stationed in Beirut at the time. This week, Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with the founding vice president of Beirut Veterans of America, Randy Gatto, about next week's ceremony.
This is a very special memorial because it marks the 30th anniversary of those tragic bombings in Beirut.
That is correct.
I know that for 2 days, October 22nd and October 23rd, your group and others will be at the Beirut Memorial in Jacksonville. Can you tell us what this event is going to entail?
Each year since 1984, families and veterans and friends have gathered at Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville. So this being the 30th, there will be literally thousands of people converging on Jacksonville. The 21st and 22nd is more sort of a fraternal order of business, more just people meeting, and we've got some more informal events planned for Beirut veterans and their families. And on the 23rd, we go really from 6 o'clock in the morning until 9:30 at night. There's a candlelight vigil for the families and close friends and veterans to remember those who are on the Beirut Veterans Wall. And we say each name out loud, and thus they live for that moment. Those men live again. And then at 10:30 is the formal Beirut remembrance that's hosted by the city of Jacksonville. And the base, Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. And then at 2 o'clock, there's a Order of the Devil Dog ceremony at Camp Geiger. And then starting at 6 o'clock that evening, we have a banquet. Pretty full day on the 23rd.
It certainly does sound like a pretty full day. Randy, can you tell us a little bit about the Beirut Veterans of America and when were you founded?
And we actually founded that in 1992. Bob Jordan, retired Major Robert Jordan, called me one day and I said, we need to form an organization so that these men are not forgotten and this whole lessons learned in Beirut is not forgotten, because we really felt that that was the beginning of the global war on terror.
Now, Randy, I know that in some of the instances, you have some of these observances going back to 1958 when President Eisenhower first sent troops
right
over to Lebanon.
That's true. I'm glad you brought that up. We went into Beirut in '58 with essentially the same type of mission. It was go in, protect American lives and American interests in that area. And we fortunately did not experience any casualties there.
Really, part of what happened between 1982 and 1983 was actually a continuation of the 1975 Civil War in Lebanon, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was a direct, these events are not isolated, none of them. They're all connected. The reason that we were called into Beirut initially was based on events that had occurred since 85, and when the PLO had eventually gotten ensconced in the Beirut area, And we were first called in, along with the French, to withdraw 15,000 or more PLO, Palestinian Liberation Army, fighters from Beirut in order to try to, because they had been entrenched there for so long.
Now, Randy, once again, when you were formed in 1992, and of course, having been in the service of this country for a very long time, you recognized the threat of worldwide terrorism, and that did you have a feeling that it was going to be continuing to the level that it is today?
Yeah, when we went in, we didn't. By the time we had experience with, you know, what we saw there, and then especially after the bombing, it was pretty clear to everybody there that this was not just an isolated incident, that this was something that was deliberately done, it was planned, it was executed with the intent. And so after we left and we started to look at the world events afterwards, it got pretty clear pretty quickly that a lot of follow-on terrorist activities were based on the success, really, of that event. But you have to also consider the fact we were not put in there as a combat force like Marines normally would be. We were put in there in a peacekeeping mode, which at that time in 1982 was very ill-defined. We couldn't walk around loaded weapons. We had to have our magazines in our pouches, and we could only shoot if fired upon, and then only if we could clearly identify the target. We were put on the low ground amidst at least 17 different armed factions, from local neighborhood militias to armies of nations. Eventually, we became the enemy. There was no operational security because we had none. We were in the middle of a busy, open international airport. So it was very difficult to establish what traditionally we know to be a good defensive position even. And so in 1983, they took advantage of the fact that they could read everything that we were doing, and that's why they were able to execute such a massive strike, because we had no capability of providing the operational security we normally would have. And they continued to use the open Western society up to and including September 11th when they hit the World Trade Center. So these extreme elements will continue to use that as long as, which is the price we pay, I guess, for being an open and free society.
Randy, how can folks get in touch with you, the Beirut Veterans of America?
The easiest way is to go online at www.beirutveterans.org, and we've got all the information there about the remembrance and everything that's going on.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Many of you in the eastern part of North Carolina have what we call warm season grasses in your lawn. These are the grasses that do best when the soil is nice and hot. They grow beautifully in the summertime and then go dormant in the winter. These grasses include centipede, St. Augustine, and Bermuda grass. And all of those grasses, as well as zoysia and some others, sometimes suffer from a fungal disease called large patch. But here's the trick. Large patch primarily shows up in the spring, and that's when folks are most aware of it and want to take care of it. But the best time to treat it is in the fall. Coming up soon. The best time to treat is right when the soil temperature falls below 70 degrees. So how do you know when your soil temperature is below 70? Well, there's a North Carolina Climate Office website. If you go to that website, there's a drop-down menu, and you can select soil temperature to find out what the soil temperature is in your part of the state. Do that to determine when to treat for large patch. Large patch is caused by a fungus and is quite common. It becomes especially a problem when folks over-fertilize their grass and it becomes too rich with nitrogen. all fungi prefer those nice, tender, nitrogen-rich plants to others. But you can get large patch even if you don't over-fertilize. It looks like a large, roughly circular patch from 2 feet to 10 feet more in diameter. The turf inside turns a orange, yellow, reddish, brown in color, and then tan and collapses altogether to the ground. The disease can spread rapidly to encompass large areas, and distinct circular patches may not be obvious once it's gone that far. The best way to manage large patch is by preventative treatment in late summer or early fall, again, when the daily soil temperatures are at 70 degrees or below. One fungicide application might control minor cases of large patch, but multiple applications, 4 to 6 weeks apart, might be necessary to control severe cases. Fungicides are not very effective once symptoms of large patch appear in the spring. So if your turf sample was diagnosed with large patch last spring, or if you have seen those irregular, roundish patches of discolored grass turning brown and dying, now might be the time to look into a fungicide for taking care of your lawn to prevent that problem from coming back next spring. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Winston Churchill is believed the source for the observation that history is written by the victors. The life and subsequent disappearance from history of a North Carolina-born slave and abolitionist illustrates the truth behind that remark. George Olson has this, which originally aired in December 2012.
David Soselsky is a historian of some note in the state, a Craven County native who was taught at Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and ECU. He's the author or editor of several books examining the history of the eastern region of the state, including works on the 1898 Wilmington race riots and maritime culture during the slave era. He is someone well-versed in the history of this region, which made his initial discovery of the subject of his latest book quite a surprise.
I have really devoted my life as a historian to telling the stories of eastern North Carolina. And while doing research for other books, I kept coming across this mysterious figure, Abraham Galloway, who I had never heard of, going behind enemy lines to rescue his mother from slavery during the war, and you know, a dozen other stories that made him seem like this larger-than-life, very mysterious and very exciting individual, but I had no idea who he was.
Galloway may be known to some degree in the state as one of the first African Americans in the state legislature. He was one of three elected in 1868, serving a single term. But in Soselsky's opinion, and as laid out in his new book, The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, Galloway was much more than just a political first in North Carolina history.
Only in time, as I did more and more research, did I come to understand that Galloway was really a national figure and probably the most important African-American figure in the American South during the Civil War. But that was actually late in my research as I followed him to sort of a now famous meeting with Abraham Lincoln and touring the North as a spokesman for African-American politics during the war.
Galloway went from slave to elected representative in a relatively short time, a slave in 1857, a state senator in 1868, made possible by the leap Galloway took when he made the decision to escape his servitude. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom.
In early 1857, young Abraham Galloway vowed to depart the world of his childhood. At 20 years old, he had lived by the banks of the Cape Fear River all his life and had never traveled more than a day's journey from his friends and family in Smithville and Wilmington. But that spring, he and a friend grew determined, they later explained, that liberty was worth dying for, and that it was their duty to strike for freedom, even if it should cost them their lives.
Galloway made the decision to leave despite having, for a slave, a relatively good life. A brick mason, he could choose his jobs as long as most of the money went to his owner, and this afforded him some bit of freedom that slaves working in a field did not enjoy. But still he left, perhaps a product of an oddity in the South at the time. His father was a white waterman, John Galloway, who, unlike most births involving free white men and enslaved black women, actually acknowledged his son with the slave Hester Hankins.
Said, "This is my son," and Abraham always said later that his father did everything he could to look after him. That had limits, of course, because he wasn't his owner, but all his life, Abraham Galloway spoke well of his father and acknowledge both sides of his heritage. And I do believe that later, as Abraham Galloway becomes such an important political figure, Abraham always went out of his way to bring together blacks and whites in political coalitions. And I think that was partly because of his family roots.
John Galloway was known as charismatic, courageous, and quick-tempered, which were probably descriptors also used to describe his son Abraham, who, after escaping from the South, returned to the South to work as a spy for the Union Army as he joined the fight against the Confederacy. But Soselsky says as fervently as Galloway fought to destroy the Confederacy, he often fought the Union Army for its treatment of slaves it encountered as it moved through the South.
And the second thing that Galloway saw down in Mississippi was the Union Army promised somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 slaves their freedom if they would help dig a vitally important canal to go around Vicksburg. That did not work, like from an engineering point of view, and the Union Army retreated. And when they retreated, they left those slaves there. So you can imagine their fate. You can imagine how slaveholders in Mississippi would treat those African-American men and women. And these were not things that a man like Abraham Galloway would quickly forgive or forget, and he didn't.
What Abraham Galloway experienced is also telling of the slave population of the time. The typical discussion of the Civil War centers around momentous battles between North and South, but David Soselsky says lost in the retelling of the war is another side, with Abraham Galloway as one of its leaders that attempted to exert its influence on the outcome.
As I did the research for the book, I really began to see there's the North and the South, the Union and the Confederacy, but then there's them. And I really began to see the African Americans of the South as a third force, always determined to destroy the Confederacy, but also wary of the Union in many ways, and with their own agenda oriented towards slave liberation.
It was perhaps what Galloway saw in the service of the Union that brought him to an interesting insight on how liberation may be found. It was to be found, not necessarily through social equality, but with access to the ballot box. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom about an address Galloway gives in 1864 at what is now St. Peter AME Zion Church in New Bern.
At Andrew Chapel, he made clear that he understood that his audience yearned for more than voting rights. He realized that those gathered there still felt the stings of 100 daily reminders of their oppression. Local customs decreed, among much else, that black men and women stepped aside for all white pedestrians, waited in line behind all white customers at stores, sat on the exposed lower decks of steamships, and never shared a dining room with whites. Galloway understood all too well how much the former slaves resented these enduring signs of racial prejudice and hostility. His revolutionary agenda included pushing aside those relics of slavery, but he insisted that they first and foremost stay fixed on voting rights. As for social equality and racial segregation, Galloway told the church that he was willing, and this is a quote, to wait a little longer. But as the Anglo-African's local correspondent quoted him, he wanted his political rights now. Though I should say, of course, that Galloway was notorious for not giving ground on sidewalks, for not conceding any indignity. But when it came to his political thinking, this was one of the most striking times where we see Galloway looking beyond the current moment to that distant future and saying, okay, we can accept some indignities now in exchange for this future vision of equality and political rights. And that was not at all a universal opinion among African American leaders in the South or North at that time. But for Galloway, it was, if we can vote, everything else will follow.
The ballot box got Galloway into the state Senate in 1868, but in terms of everything else will follow, Galloway did not live long enough to shepherd that forward. He died suddenly in 1870 at the age of 33, a time when some of what blacks had won at the ballot box started to retrench and soon gave way to Jim Crow in the South. When Galloway died, it was reported that his funeral was the largest the state had seen up to that time. But soon Galloway was an ignored figure in state history, washed out by an historical narrative that Galloway's radical abolitionism did not fit neatly into.
He was a brilliant individual who really, I really consider one of the most important African-American figures in American history. But for 125 years, I'm sure that no school child ever uttered his name. immediately after the war, of course, he wasn't forgotten, but in coming years, the South and the North, to some degree, created this almost mythical image of the Civil War. I guess we could call it sort of the Gone with the Wind version. And let's face it, it's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway, who wore two pistols at his hip, punched out Union naval officers, went behind enemy lines to rescue his mother, and would stop at nothing in the struggle for freedom. It's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway in Gone with the Wind.
David Soselsky is the author of The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, published by UNC Press. I'm George Olson.
David Soselsky will talk about his book, The Fire of Freedom, next Friday, the 25th, at an event sponsored by the Beaufort Women's Club at Purvis Chapel in Beaufort at 7 p.m. In addition to his talk, there will be a performance by the AME Zion Conference Choir. This event will benefit efforts to preserve the circa 1820 Purvis Chapel.